Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to get to have this opportunity to be here on Easter Monday with you. And it's always a pleasure to be here. It's always a great pleasure. But isn't it something about any time you can be with fellow Christians in the Easter season, it just makes you feel great. And so thanks for giving us this opportunity to be with you on Easter Monday. All this week is Easter, as a matter of fact. Maybe we'll ask Tim about that, why these Catholics say Happy Easter for a whole week and then pretty much don't stop for another month. But Easter's a big deal to us. This hour, we're going to talk a bit about, the resurrection, which seems to me, I am not a theologian, but that does seem to me to be one of the important parts of Easter. Easter would be a very dull day without it. Tim Staples, thanks for being here with us.
You mean it's more important than the chocolate bunnies?
Even more important than, well, I suppose it depends on your age. or how you're going to answer that question. But it does. First of all, happy Easter, Tim.
Happy Easter. He is risen.
Amen. He is truly risen. Now, some people say it another way, and they get mad at me when I say it that way. They say,
he is risen indeed.
He's risen indeed. Yeah, yes. Right. But I think I say it a little more of the Orthodox than the Latin way. But
there you go.
My bad. But you know what? I'll say it either way because he is risen, amen. And I just want to celebrate it. All right, so Tim, the resurrection, nice story.
Yes, and it is.
That's true. It is a nice story, but is it more than a nice story?
Yes, it is. As St. Paul said, if Christ be not raised from the dead, then we are of all men, most to be pitied, as one translation says, but we are of all men most miserable, because the whole thing, of course, collapses if Jesus is not raised from the dead. And, you know, this are one of our absolute fundamental teachings, always at this time of the year. Just turn on the History Channel and you'll have all kinds of specials showing how actually he was not resurrected, and we can prove it.
I know Time Magazine will get helpful this time of year. Newsweek, yes. They always have some helpful explainer that will explain you right out of your faith.
Yeah, and it's the same old tired arguments every year.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, this is absolutely crucial for us as Catholic Christians. As Christians in general, we need to be able to give a reason for the hope that lies within us. And so there's no better time than now to do just that.
Well, you know, we were just talking in the last hour with the great Rod Bennett about the apostles' reaction,
and
he said to me, "How would you classify the apostles' reaction?" And his thing was, most people would say joy, and he says, "Actually, read the Gospels; it's not joy. It's kind of a what is going on here? They don't
yes.
get it. They don't, or the processing of it is very difficult."
Yes.
So even those who were present for the historical fact of it.
Yes.
Had to struggle with the historical fact of it, to accept it as an actual fact.
Yeah, and that's, you and I have talked about this before, but that's a huge part of the puzzle is understanding, and I know Rod talked about that a lot, the psychology of the apostles, what was going on in their minds. And I think a lot of Christians, and I've read a few Catholics as well, miss it on this when they talk about how, you know, the apostles were cowards because, as we see in John chapter 20, they were hiding for fear of the Jews. And I think that misses the boat almost, I don't want to say entirely, but it misses the boat because, no, the apostles were anything but cowards. I mean, but Peter shows that in the garden when the mob comes to take Jesus. And, of course, he cuts off Malchus's ear. He was ready to fight and die.
Yeah, right.
But what happened was when they see their Messiah, the Lord, who they'd seen raise the dead and perform miracles, and they knew this was the Messiah that was going to take over the world, and he's hanging on a cross. This was, when he was arrested and taken away, and Peter is told to put up his sword. We cannot even imagine the disillusionment. And I think that is what is at the core of their fear. It's not cowardice at all, but it's disillusionment. It reminds me of, my favorite movie I talk about all the time, It's a Wonderful Life. You know, when Joseph, the senior angel, is telling Clarence Angel Second Class, Clarence Oddbody, about his mission to be the guardian angel for George Bailey. And Clarence asks Joseph the question, oh, is he sick? You remember what Joseph says? Worse, he's discouraged.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It's a great line.
Right,
because,
right.
Yeah, it's the disillusionment. They were absolutely devastated, and that led to what? And they run. And so, oh, it's absolutely so. You're empathetic when you read the Gospels in Matthew, what is it, 27 and 56, when it says they all fled.
Yeah.
They were absolutely disillusioned, which led to that paralyzing fear and not knowing what's coming next. And their whole world had collapsed. And that's important for what we're going to talk about in this hour from a historical perspective, you know, how we know this is, in fact, an historical fact. But I think just to start off, to get that in our heads, you know, that they were disillusioned to such a point. When you then read some of, you know, the explanations for the empty tomb and such, which we'll get to, they really fall apart.
So you mean, when you say historical fact, you mean
yes.
The body of Jesus of Nazareth lay dead in a tomb,
yes,
and left that tomb alive. And you mean that in within history, like just the same as like George Washington is a historical figure and Napoleon's a historical figure and all that. You're saying
yes.
You're not leaving any room for symbolism, mythology, or
right.
a spiritual resurrection that's not physical.
Yeah, you know,
is that where we are?
That's where we are. In fact, the Catechism of the Catholic Church makes a bold statement in section 643 when it says it is impossible not to acknowledge that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is an historical fact. Now, of course, the Catechism a little later will also talk about how it transcends history as well at the same time. And that's not a contradiction,
right,
because it is an historical fact rooted in a bodily resurrection, visible and such. But of course, the mystery of the resurrection far transcends time and space, because it is, you know, the fact that he is the God-man who conquered death in rising from the dead, and all of that involves the mysteries of the faith. But as its core, as an event, it is an historical fact.
And on what basis do we make that claim?
Do we have 3 hours?
I wish we did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think first you have to start with the reliability of the story itself. And I think F.F. Bruce, in his masterpiece, boy, that guy could get it done for a Protestant fella. You know? But then the New Testament scriptures, are they reliable, in his classic work? I mean, he really nails it on this. But you first, whenever you're investigating any historical event, you have to look at, okay, what are our sources, right? That's what we do for any event. Well, when it comes to the New Testament, the evidence is absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, you have a man like Sir William Ramsay, you know, the famous 19th century archaeologist and historian, who was a part of the Tübingen school in Germany,
which is the school of we're not so sure of anything.
That's right. And so, you know, he writes about how when he investigated and set out to investigate, and he was working on Luke, Acts as historical documents, he was presupposing he was going to just make Swiss cheese out of this thing. And when he dove in, he ended up converting.
Yeah.
And he found Luke, Acts to be the most accurate documents of antiquity by far, and there's nothing close. And F.F. Bruce points out the fact that whenever you're looking at a particular event, you examine, okay, who's writing about it? What are the manuscripts? You know, how close to the event are they? How many of them do we have? And so forth. And, you know, as F.F. Bruce points out, when you look at the New Testament, the evidence is so overwhelming because, first of all, the numbers of manuscripts, you have well over 5,000. Now, when we say manuscripts, we're talking about documents written by hand, as the word manuscript means, by hand, before the advent of the printing press, which is AD 1450. You're talking over 5,000 manuscripts,
yeah.
right? And by the way, these are manuscripts that are written, there are several different families in different languages and literally all over the world. It's unprecedented. Just to give you a sense of this, over 5,000 manuscripts. Compare that to Caesar's Gallic Wars, F.F. Bruce points out. You have 9 manuscripts, right? The Roman History of Livy, 20 manuscripts. The Annals of Tacitus, you have 2 manuscripts, okay? The History of Thucydides, you have 8 manuscripts. And on we could go. There's a whole Herodotus and so forth. And it's on and on. It's 2 manuscripts, 9 manuscripts, and so forth. Over 5,000 manuscripts. And then when you add to that, how close are they to the actual event? Well, Caesar's Gallic Wars, the oldest manuscript we have is 900 years after the autograph. And that's one of the better manuscripts of antiquity.
And we know that that really is Caesar's, like that 900 years, no one goes, yeah, so that means it's not really what Caesar wrote. It is what Caesar wrote.
Yeah, that is the most important point here, is that no historian denies the historicity of any of the documents and the events that they are recounting that I just mentioned, and there's so many more. But yet we have the manuscripts of the New Testament that date now. In fact, F.F. Bruce, when I was kind of rereading his book again, and I noticed that when he was talking about the antiquity, let me cite you here from F.F. Bruce. He says, the John Rylands Papyrus, as it is called, represents a fragment of a papyrus codex containing a section of John, now in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, dated to around 130 AD. Now, since the time of F.F. Bruce, this has actually been, in fact, there's a great work by Philip Comfort and David Barrett, a very scholarly work that came out just in the last 10 years, the text of the earliest New Testament Greek manuscripts. On page 365, it points out that this P52, which is part of these earliest Greek manuscripts, has now been dated to around 100 AD to 125. So it's even, older than what F.F. Bruce knew back then. So the point is, and we have complete manuscripts, you know, of the New Testament that date, you know, to now the 3rd century, 4th century. Well, then 4th century, you have Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, the entire Bible and such. It's just extraordinary as far as this is the foundation. These are the documents and such. This is absolutely extraordinary. But then when you add to that the fact that these manuscripts, let's look at, you know, Acts chapter 1, 2 Peter chapter 1, Acts chapter 26, you know, when Peter or St. Paul is famously preaching the gospel basically to Festus, the Roman governor, and Agrippa, the Jewish quote-unquote king. They constantly, and we could go back to Acts chapter 2, Peter's first homily there at Pentecost. You have this repeated all over the New Testament and all those documents I just mentioned. They appeal to the fact that they are eyewitnesses of these events, number one. And number two, like with Paul talking to Festus and Agrippa, this thing wasn't done in a corner, he says.
Yeah.
You saw this.
Yeah.
He's talking about Jesus' miracles and so forth that he performed. And of course, he mentions the resurrection as well. And he says, this thing wasn't done in a corner. You know this. And he's pointing to, whether it's Peter at Pentecost, whether he's writing in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, or John in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, and they all are saying we were eyewitnesses of his glory. See, this is extraordinary because not only were they eyewitnesses, but the people they were talking to, many of them, were also eyewitnesses. This, from a purely historical perspective, lends all kinds of credence to what they're saying, because you're not at liberty to just make stuff up.
Yeah.
When you got folks standing in the yard, hey, right. I was there, dude. You know,
right.
You're not going to put that one over on me. And not only the foes, because the foes are going to try to catch you in anything they can catch you in so they can get rid of you. But remember now, in the early years, decades, as Christianity grows and you still have those eyewitnesses, St. Paul talks about over 500 eyewitnesses, and he says many of them are still alive. In fact, most of them are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. I mean, these are eyewitnesses. They're gonna check every detail and make sure, because these are believers. They became believers through their experience of the resurrected Lord. And so they are going to be all over you if you mess up one jot or one tittle. Extraordinary. And again, as I mentioned, you have enemies as well. So you better get your story straight. So the idea, and you know, this, from the skeptic's point of view, probably the most popular of the anti-Christian sort of myths created to say, oh, you know, this thing is bogus, is, in at least in today's world, is, oh, these guys just made it up. You know, it's a huge hoax, the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on mankind. And that just explodes in the examination of the actual data. And so much does it explode, Cy, that even some of the professional skeptics, you know, like Klausner, the Jewish skeptic from 1930s, as well as Kersop Lake, who was also a famous skeptic, in about 1907, neither one of those guys could any longer say, you know, this was a hoax created by Jesus and the apostles, because when you examine the evidence of their lives, it falls apart. Jesus is the one in John chapter 8, says, which of you can convince me of any sin? And they could not do it. The apostles, as we mentioned, these men who were devastated in fear, disillusionment, ran when Jesus was arrested and crucified. We're going to say that these guys got themselves together and say, hey, let's create a hoax, people. Yeah. And then, of course, you'd have to get 500 other eyewitnesses all on the same, you know, all on board. And keep, you know, if ever you're going to do a major crime, especially a swindle or scam like this, you want to have the fewest amount of people possible involved.
Yeah,
because right. Your stories are going to get so twisted up so quickly when the authorities come down on you. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of eyewitnesses as a matter of historical fact. And these witnesses, the apostles alone, 11 out of 12 of them went to their deaths. I mean, they went from being afraid for their lives and running to being crucified, you know, thrown to the lions,
right.
Arrows through their bodies.
Nice hoax you got
in
there.
In order to perpetuate a lie. I mean, that's why skeptics like Klausner and Kersop Lake came up with other myths. Maybe we can talk about
those
later.
Let's do it when we come back, because I got to take a break. Okay, we'll do that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a doctor of the church, a Carmelite, and one of the most famous mystics of all time.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of the Cross wanted to help all Christians to become saints. One of his most important teachings was to encourage us all to learn how to love. For there is no love, he said, put love, and you will find love. He died in 1591.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Tim Staples is our guest. A very happy Easter to you. And we're talking first about the resurrection. First of all, about the evidence for the resurrection. I asked you about that, Tim. And
yeah.
You know, you can say earlier manuscripts for the Gospels than any other ancient writing. More
by far.
More sources. I mean, four Gospels, by all the far. Letters than any life in the ancient world. And a high quality of stuff, like not the manuscripts that we have are very high quality stuff, right right to within decades of the life of Jesus himself, some of the fragments go. But then a lot of people...
And if you think about it, I mentioned P52, the Rylands manuscript there of John's gospel dated now to between 100... I mean, John died.
Wrote it.
John died in about 90, 95. I mean, we're talking 5 years within.
That's really unheard of, actually. Imagine if somebody found something that, here's a copy of Caesar's commentaries from 20 years after Caesar. You'd say that's one of the great finds of history.
We have it in the New Testament. Yeah,
but here's the problem. People will say, yeah, Tim, I get it. All of those sources are Christians.
Right.
They all come from people who already have a dog in this fight.
Yes, absolutely. And even though, as we said in the last segment, we shouldn't back down on the fact that these men that we're talking about were of impeccable character. You know, and I'll quote again Joseph Klausner, the Jewish skeptic back in the 1930s, who said, when you examine the lives, I find this extraordinary because he's an honest Jewish fellow investigating this stuff, and he was a scholar. But he said, the one thing you cannot say is these men were scoundrels, because their lives were impeccable, and there was such an honesty about them. Klausner talks about how, you know, the apostles don't hide the fact. They don't hide the fact that they all fled. Yeah. They don't hide the fact that Peter denied Jesus three times, and he was their leader, you know? I mean, they were brutally honest about their own failings. But at the same time, that doesn't take away from, that adds to the credence or you know, to the reliability of these testimonies because of their incredible testimony. And then when you get into the fact of Jesus, are you kidding me? Jesus being involved, you know, as some of the theories like swoon theory, which again we'll talk about later. I mean, that's unthinkable, and that's why some of the later theories came along, like the swoon theory, to try to explain the empty tomb. But you really don't want to go down the path of saying these men were scoundrels and they just lied. That absolutely makes no sense whatsoever given the historical facts. But let's to answer your question, right? Well, these are all Christian sources. Well, the fact is we have a large number, comparatively speaking, to any other document or historical event, we have a huge number of ancient, non-Christian testimonies to the veracity of the New Testament. Let me give you some examples. Cornelius Tacitus, who was born around 54 AD, writes in what is acknowledged by all to be one of the most important historical writings of the first century. He writes about, and without getting into quoting all the details and such, he acknowledges, in fact, the existence of Christ. He calls him Christus here, and of the Christian community, the growing Christian community in the first century. And he writes about it as a historian, as if everybody reading this already knows this to be true. That's extraordinary. I was going to read it, but for time's sake, Lucian the Satirist, writing in about AD 170, he too, a satirist, you know, he was a bit harsh in his writing and whatnot, but he acknowledges once again the fact not only of Jesus' existence, but that he was crucified. He calls him a sophist and whatnot. He's a satirist, and he's going to be doing that sort of thing. But he talks about the Christian community worshiping this sophist who was crucified, you know, under Pontius Pilate and that sort of thing. And then you have Flavius Josephus, who also writes about Christ and the Christian. Suetonius, another Roman historian. You have Pliny the Younger, the governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor, who writes about the Christians, the followers of Jesus. And to me, Thallus, you have a Samaritan-born historian. This is extraordinary because here you have a fellow who's first attempting to explain away the events that had just occurred. And he's writing in the 50s of the first century. right? We're around 50-55. And I do have to quote this one. He tries to explain away the eclipse that happened at the time of the death of Jesus. Now, this is extraordinary because he's acknowledging this event. It had only happened 20 years before, right? But he's trying to explain it away. And he said, he explains, this darkness is an eclipse of the sun. Now, of course, that's absurd. It's not a very good critique because you can't have an eclipse of the sun at the time of the Passover. Why?
Because the moon.
The moon. We're talking about a full moon. And so you can't have an eclipse. But the point
Let's do it.
Is,
we got to.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be right back. If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Easter Monday. Talking with Tim Staples about the resurrection right now, doing some of the evidence for the resurrection. And the kind of challenge I made to you is the challenge I'm sure you've heard many times is, Tim, we got all those manuscripts. They're high quality manuscripts and all of it. But all the evidence of all the early evidence of Christ is from Christians. So why should we trust it? And you're in the midst of, you've mentioned several things.
Yeah, I've mentioned six, but let's go to number seven. This one is my favorite. The letter of Mara Bar Serapion, which you can see today in the British Museum in Manchester, England, which I was talking to Cy. I have not been there yet, but I am going to get there. And Cy hasn't been either. We should go together.
All right. Yeah. We got to go to that chicken place in Sydney, Australia first.
We got to do that. That's right. But you have there the letter of a man, Mara Bar Serapion. Okay. That's his name. He was actually writing from prison to his son. And in this letter, he writes about how that, and again, I have it written here, but without taking too much time, he's saying how they really made a mistake. The Jews and the Romans made a big mistake in crucifying this guy, this Jesus guy, because, and he compares him to Socrates, and he said, it was a mistake, and Pythagoras as well. Pythagoras and Socrates, of course, were both martyred, and they became more popular after their martyrdom. And so he's basically saying to his son, they they messed up in crucifying this guy because now he's more popular than he was before. He's everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? This Jesus guy. I mean, that's extraordinary. And again, this is written in about AD 73. This is extraordinary. He's got no dog in the fight, if I could quote you, Cy, from
no,
your question.
He's just giving a list of you killed these famous people, and they got more popular. Pythagoras, Socrates, right. and
you didn't learn your lesson because look at what's happening with this Jesus guy. And this, the explosion of the manuscripts and the growth of Christianity was so extraordinary. Within one generation, you reached the entire known world. Of course, they didn't know about the New World yet, but they reached the entire known world. In fact, in AD 150, Justin Martyr, in his first apology, which he's writing an apologetic to the Emperor Antoninus Pius, but he writes about how the Gospels were then all over the world and in multiple languages around the world, and this is in 150 AD. Attesting to this same event all over the world. I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary. And let me toss out the Jewish Talmud here, because I threw in Justin Martyr there just to give us a sense of the antiquity and the growth. But he's obviously a Christian.
Yeah.
But the Jewish Talmud, F.F. Bruce gives remarkable evidence from the Talmud, which, if you understand its origins, it becomes crucial to this discussion. The Talmud consists of the Mishnah, which was an early codification of the tradition of the elders of the Jews, that as it's mentioned in the Gospels. So this was an oral collection of case law based on interpretations of law given by rabbis over the centuries. It first began to be codified in about AD 90, and then it was written in about the 3rd through the 6th century. So this is very ancient stuff. But what does the Talmud say about Jesus? Well, the Talmud never attempts to deny Jesus' existence, for example, as you have some radical skeptics today who attempt to do. And if anybody was going to want to do that, it would have been the Talmuds and the Jewish authorities, because Christianity was growing all over the place and many Jews had converted as a result. And definitely, if you read the Talmuds, it is very anti-Christian, let's face it. But it acknowledges, for example, that refers to Jesus as a sorcerer. There's no attempt to even deny the miracles of Jesus. Rather, no, but he did it as a sorcerer by the power of the devil. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that's right. That was the accusation made to Jesus by some Jewish authorities during his life.
During his lifetime. And that is the same thing. That myth continued to be made by the Jews. So the point is, I just gave you eight examples of, and there are more, but of non-Christians all testifying, and some of them to the crucifixion of the Lord, the miracles of the Lord. These are absolutely extraordinary. So we're not just talking about a Christian-only club when it comes to the attestation of the historicity of the Christ event.
So we affirm then with the church itself affirms that you must acknowledge this as a historical fact.
And, correct.
And the church is not saying that only because faith requires that. They're saying a reasonable look at the data of history says this is a fact.
Absolutely. Correct. And in the creed, folks, think about it, Catholics. Every Sunday we say, was crucified under Pontius Pilate. I've been asked this question on Catholic Answers Live. Why in the world do we have
Pontius Pilate?
A monster.
Yeah.
And he was not exactly a nice guy, folks. I mean, we look at Luke chapter 13 and what he was doing to the Jews in the first century. I mean, he was not a nice guy, but there he is. And why is that? Because of the importance of the historical reality of what we're talking about. Because if Christ be not raised from the dead, we are of all men most to be pitied. Our faith is rooted in historic. See, and that's why, if you go, I mentioned earlier, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, where St. Peter says, we have not followed cunningly devised mythos, right? Myths,
right.
As the pagans, but we are eyewitnesses of his glory. eyewitness is everything to St. Peter and to all of the apostles, and it is to our Catholic Christian faith. Those who want to make some sort of symbol out of the resurrection, even some people who call themselves Christian, I'm sorry. You deny the resurrection,
you don't
even get off the starting blocks. You're not a Christian.
All right, so what are some ways then? Because you say, okay, the historical evidence, to say nothing of the evidence of faith, but the historical evidence is overwhelming in favor of the testimony of the ancient church to the resurrect, to the fact that Jesus rose from the dead.
Yep.
So give me some ways people try to explain that away in the modern period.
Yeah, and I think, first of all, I would say that the fact that what we're about to see here are kind of the best of the... We're talking professional skeptics here. These are not just, you know, Billy Bob down and say, I don't believe in that Jesus stuff. But we're talking scholars who are trying to give an account of what happened in the first century as skeptics. What's extraordinary is what they came up with, as we're going to see, I argue, proves the veracity of the events. In fact, it's harder to believe the skeptics than it is.
There you go.
I mean, it would require more faith for me to believe the skeptics' attempts to discredit the resurrection than the resurrection itself. And let's toss out a few of them here. Number one, the hallucination theory, right? And this gained a little bit of ground and still has some currency, a small amount. But the hallucination theory, meaning that the apostles, you see, they wanted Jesus to be resurrected so badly that they hallucinated this event. And so there was a kind of collective hallucination. And then it gets out of hand. And then next thing you know, we have Cy Kellett sitting here with Tim Staples talking about it. Now, you know, obviously, folks, there are huge problems with this. And hallucination, right? Okay, well, number one, we're talking about hundreds of people having to hallucinate the same event, which is absurd. Any psychologist or psychiatrist worth his salt will tell you that's simply impossible. You can have someone hallucinate all kinds of stuff. But when you go beyond one, hallucination becomes extremely difficult. Yeah. When you get to 500, it is absolutely impossible. It's unthinkable. And then when you get into the details of what the folks saw, for example, you have Cleopas and the Undamed Disciple who see Jesus resurrected under a different form than the others. So he didn't appear the same way to everyone that he appeared to. So we're not talking about everybody hallucinating the same thing in that sense.
Right.
And they would have to be hallucinating the resurrection, but I'm talking about the particulars of what they saw were very different. It was at different times. It wasn't like there was a bright light and everybody saw and was blinded by something and confused. But we're talking about hundreds of appearances over a 40-year period.
40 years?
Yeah, when he ascended, after he ascended.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, so he 40, did I say 40 years? I meant 40 days.
Yeah, okay.
Did I just say 40 years?
I was like, what's he talking about? Oh, yeah. Okay, so the 40, yeah, so 40 after
days.
The resurrection,
yes.
40 days of appearing all over the place.
That's right, and Paul recounts in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the multiple, some to Peter alone, to all the apostles, you know, to the holy women and so forth, multiple appearances over a 40-day, not 40 years, 40-day period. Hallucination literally is, it's not just unthinkable, it's impossible.
So yeah, I mean, that's just a made-up thing.
It
just seems like such a kind of...
And you can see why... I said earlier it would require more faith to believe that over 500 people could have the same hallucination than what the historical facts are. These people's lives were changed by the resurrected Lord that they saw. They went from running in fear, absolutely disheartened, to becoming St. Peter proclaiming the gospel before the world in Acts chapter 2, them being arrested multiple times and eventually martyred. What in the world? Something happened there to transform them, and according to them, it's, they saw the resurrected Lord. That is entirely more believable than to say there was a hallucination that happened and multiple times over a 40-day period. Absolutely.
Well, then you dealt a little bit with the hoax one, but is there more you want to say on that? I mean, the idea that this, okay, they stole the body, this is a hoax.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I mean, I could go down a litany of examples of the fact. It gets back to what we said before, the character of the people involved. I mean, you're talking about what kind of hoax would this, I mean, how many characters would it involve? And then look at the character of the characters involved. Because in order for it to be a hoax, well, then Jesus had to be involved, because somehow you have to have Jesus. If now we're getting past the hallucination theory here, if they only hallucinated it. But even let's forget about Jesus being involved. We'll get to that later. But what would have to be involved in getting all these 500 people and these men of incredible, impeccable character together on this thing is just crazy, because all you need is one person to break and say, you know what, guys, I want to save my life. It didn't happen. All right. I was just upset and this or that. I mean, it's just, again, I would end it this first part on simply, it's unthinkable given the historical facts as well as the characters of the ones involved.
You mentioned the swoon theory. When we come back from the break, I want to know what the swoon theory is.
Ah, gotcha.
All right, we'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Marcus Grody and his son John Mark talk about the journey home.
How do I feel about passing the baton to my son? I am very excited about that.
It's weird to be stepping into my dad's role here. I'm humbled and honored, obviously, by the privilege and by his confidence in EWTN's and the audiences. In some sense, this is something I've been around all my life.
The journey continues on The Journey Home, tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio and Television.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus, but this hour, taking some time to consider the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus. It is a historical fact, something that certainly transcends nature and history in the way that other events do not, but it is also a thing that happened within history and has historical consequences all down through the ages. It's a fact. Jesus rose from the dead physically, the body of Jesus, not some spiritual resurrection, not some symbolic thing. So that's what we're talking about with Tim, and I'm asking him now, we've covered some ground, but about some modern theories to suggest, I got a better explanation for why that tomb was empty.
Right.
And we talked about the mass hallucination, which is just a made-up thing. There's no such thing as a mass hallucination like this.
That's right.
The stole the body, right?
Maybe we should talk about that one.
You want to talk about they stole the body?
Yeah, they stole the body. Maybe we should do that before we do the swoon theory.
Okay.
And actually, they kind of dovetail. And actually, what we'll talk about here will also go a long way toward discrediting the hallucination theory as well, because the they stole the body theory is not obviously new. This goes back to Matthew chapter 27. This is what the Jews attempted to argue in the first century. But the problem with this is, and again, this dovetails with hallucination, is because you have the testimony of the Roman guards. right?
Oh, yeah.
That, hey, you know, we fell asleep. It wasn't our fault. How do we explain the fact that the body is gone?
Right.
Right? Well, they stole the body.
Yeah.
Right? We fell asleep and they stole the body. And you'll notice that in Matthew 27, when the authorities say, this is the story you're going to tell, those Romans who were guarding the tomb were probably petrified in fear, because we know as a historical fact that Romans, failure was not an option when you're given an assignment to guard a tomb. We see with the Philippian jailer in Acts chapter 16, remember.
He was going to kill himself.
He was going to kill himself.
The punishment was going
to
be so bad.
When the walls came down and Paul and Silas are sitting there with their fetters gone, they're like, okay, I'm going to kill myself now. Hey, don't do that. And we know the story. So, you know, if it was a hallucination merely of these apostles, enter the Romans, enter the Jews who are trying to explain this away and so forth. Where does that come? All right. But now you do have to deal with this ancient sort of explanation of they stole the body, right? Now, I mentioned this briefly, and probably we'd need to give it a little bit more work here because it is such an ancient argument, goes back 2,000 years. But think about it in context. We're talking about a crucifixion that happened on Good Friday, okay? When would they have stolen the body, number one, okay? Because we have the women who were there. They attempted to prepare his body, but they couldn't do the complete job because of the oncoming Sabbath. So they come early in the morning, just after sunrise on Easter or Sunday morning. So when would the apostles have stolen the body? Well, what do we see the apostles doing at this time? They would have had to have stolen the body either during the Sabbath, which is unthinkable for a Jew, number one. And these are all practicing Jews, very much so. But then you have the problem of the guards and so forth. So they would have had to have stolen the body sometime within, after Jesus died, yes, we're saying that now, on Good Friday. And very early morning, the ladies are coming there to take care of his body. So when did they steal it?
Yeah.
Well, at this time, when they allegedly were going to steal the body, they were running for their lives. They were hiding. This is the historical context, right? This is what happened. They ran. Peter is denying, I don't know the man. You know, get away from me. And they are literally, as I mentioned in Matthew 27:56, all the apostles fled, absolutely disillusioned and in fear. So the idea that they're going to get together and come up with this plan, we're going to go steal the body. Now, you have Roman guards with a Roman seal on the tomb with a massive stone put in front of it, so large that when the women came, they couldn't altogether roll it. They needed help. No single person is going to roll this stone. I mean, you're going to have multiple people. And do you think that, now again, the story, for they stole the body, the Romans were told to say, well, we fell asleep and they stole the body. Okay, you fell asleep, number one, when your life is on the line. I'm sorry, the Roman guards are not going to be snoozing when their lives are on the line. But again, for argument's sake, okay, they fell asleep. So you're going to sneak past them and you're going to move this massive stone and they're not going to wake up.
Yeah, right.
And see that something is going on. I mean, you're talking about a massive boulder that you're going to have to move. Then you're going to have to steal the body. Then you're going to have to do something with the body. You got to discard the body. And again, for these men who are devout Jews and have such a high respect for the body, they're not going to take the body of their that they believe to be the Messiah and just chop it up or throw it away or something like that. I mean, so then you've got to discard the body, and you've got the problem of if anybody finds the body, and that's all the Romans or the Jews would have to do, would be to find the body. And all of this has to happen within a one-day period when the historical record shows these guys were running for their lives. They were scared to death. They had scattered. Again, it requires more faith to believe in the story concocted than it does to believe in the resurrection itself.
We only got a few minutes left. Will you give me the swoon theory?
Oh, my goodness. How can we almost be done here? But yeah, the swoon theory. Now, this comes out of, again, an attempt to find some sort of reason, and the first two just aren't cutting it. So the swoon theory says, and this is Friedrich Schleiermacher's favorite. Well, you know what happened? He died. Jesus died, but he wasn't really dead.
He was only mostly dead.
He was dead. He had lost a lot of blood. He swooned. He passed out. They buried him, and of course, the cool air of the evening and such
that'll happen
comes in.
After you're crucified, often the cool air will wake you right back up again.
He wakes back up, and we're off to the races. And of course, there's so many problems with this. All right, so we have this guy who was beaten so terribly that, okay, even if he does come back to life, so to speak, he's going to move that massive boulder. He's got to get everybody together. Now you have Jesus involved with this massive scam, which is impossible. He's not going to be able to move the stone.
And where did he go?
Anyway.
Miami? Where did he move?
Right. Where does he go? Then you got to keep him for the rest of his life hidden. Yeah. And then what happens when he finally dies later on? I mean, there's just a multiplication of problems with this. And this is not to mention that the Romans were masters of crucifixion. They knew how to kill people. And we have the story of St. Longinus when he sticks the sword into Jesus' side, blood and water comes out, which indicates, doctors tell us, right, the piercing of the myocardium, and the blood and water comes out of the sac around the heart. He was a dead guy. The Romans knew it. Everyone knew it. And, of course, his mama knew it. His mom is the one. Don't tell his mom that he's not dead, because she knew it. He was placed into her arms, we know historically. And, unfortunately, I wish we had more time to talk about, you know, Kersop, Lake, and Klausner himself, who their arguments, more recent, 1907, 1930s, that I mentioned before, it was a mishap. The women came back and went to the wrong tomb.
Whoops.
So they
it's like
thought,
a comedy.
They thought the tomb was empty, but it really wasn't. And of course, that's absurd. They were there. Are they really going to go to the wrong tomb? I mean,
I see the Romans over there guarding that tomb, but I know this is the one he was in.
And then you have Klausner, who finally, who says, well, no, it wasn't that. It was Joseph of Arimathea just moved the body and didn't tell anyone. So they went to the right tomb, but the body wasn't there any longer. I mean, it's okay, Mr. Klausner, you'd think anybody would think of asking Joseph of Arimathea,
right?
Hey, where's the body, man? Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, it's over there. I mean, there's a few more that we could talk about, but the stories trying to explain away the empty tomb, I'm telling you, for me, they're a bolster of my faith. They are bolstering my faith.
Yeah, like if you had to come up with that, then you're really grasping at straws, because none of these are convincing at all.
You really are. And the fact is, the transformed lives of the apostles, which is a matter of historical record, the fact that Peter was crucified upside down, Andrew with arrows, and so many of the others that were killed in various and sundry ways, all proclaiming the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. St. Paul himself, who was a later eyewitness by revelation of who Jesus is, went from being an enemy of Christ to a believer. That's a whole nother line
of
argumentation.
That's a very convincing story, because here you have
enemies who become Christian because they saw the risen Lord.
And then write about it in their own hand. I mean, what else do you need?
And was beheaded for it.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Happy Easter to you.
Happy Easter.
And to all of yours.
And can I say one last thing?
Yes.
He is risen.
Amen. He is risen indeed. Tim Staples has been our guest. Thanks for joining us. We get to wish you Happy Easter all this week, and we're glad we get to. And it's the truth. This really happened. This is a historical fact. And the important thing about it is, maybe for you to consider, is it applies to you. That this is, he's the first of many fruits. He's the first fruit. So praise Jesus, praise God And thank God for Jesus. And this Easter, we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, Catholic Answers Live.